Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest, our second Gabfest for June 26th. There's Marriage Equality Edition. I'm David Plotz. I am in the Slate DC studio. John Dickerson is somewhere else. He's at CBS of Face the Nation. And Emily Bazelon is pulled over by the side of the road, where she both wrote an article and now is doing a podcast.
That really not kind of, to be recommended, let us say.
Yeah, don't get hit while we're doing this. Stay in the car, Emily. Do not get
out
of the car.
No, I'm like way off the road.
She's driven into the middle of a field.
I'm just hot because I'm sitting in the car.
Then you're having the experience that John and I have every week in our studio. So it's
true enough.
That's what's going on. Emily, take us away. The case, which is Obergefell versus Dodges, what is it? They need a more euphonic name for this case.
I know, right? It's going to take us a while to even pronounce it. But yes, we have marriage equality. We have the right to get married if you are a gay couple throughout the entire country. In one big bang, with a lot of drama and grand language about our evolving progressive Constitution in the hands of Justice Anthony Kennedy and four liberals on the court, and very much to the despair of the four conservatives on the court, who all wrote to say that this is an act of judicial supremacy, that it bypassed the democratic process in a really destructive way. So it's like a really well-joined fight over how you make big social change.
As you read the case, Emily, what is the case that Justice Kennedy makes against this idea that this is judicial supremacy? Where does he find the constitutional case for marriage equality, which the conservatives
really
say doesn't exist?
Yeah, well, he can't argue with judicial supremacy directly, I don't think. But he does make a constitutional case. He talks about how the definition of liberty changes over time in this country and has before. And his best precedent is Loving versus Virginia, the 1967 ruling in which the court overturned state bans against interracial marriage. That's a really good moment in which the court did a kind of similar move to the one it is making today. But you have to be okay with this notion that the Constitution changes over time and that it's okay for the Supreme Court to basically, in a big move, express that understanding and enforce it on the whole country in a way that overturns a bunch of state laws and people's traditional understanding up until now of what marriage has consisted of.
John, does this decision have any political import? Does this make any difference in the political debates that we're having?
Well, I don't know. There's this huge way in which it affects our political debates that I'm trying to wrestle with, which is this is, as the president said, in the Rose Garden for the second day in a row. He was in the Rose Garden, talked about this thunderclap of justice. So he said, you know, progress in this country often comes in small increments, sometimes two steps forward, one step back, propelled by persistent effort. And then he says there are days when justice arrives like a thunderbolt. So in this big, big way, both this decision and in different ways, and I'd love you guys to help explain to me if there's a commonality, but in different ways, you also are seeing some small amount of change in South Carolina, obviously for a hugely different reason. And then yesterday, the Affordable Care Act, after 6 years of battle, there was a change there. I think the big, big message here politically is that, and people have been doing this for a while, but now it's even more powerful, is that people have said, look at how fast public opinion has changed on the issue of same-sex marriage, and why can't we have that pace of change on other things? Now, we've talked a million times about why that's the case and why this has moved so fast, but I think still, in a larger sense, people are going to sort of say it is possible for the country to make huge leaps. And then the question is, why did it make it, and can that be replicated on another front? In this case, it's that the kind of politics caught up with the public, both in terms of the fact that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama campaigned against same-sex marriage in 2008, or didn't campaign against it, but they were not in favor of it. And, you know, the Supreme Court has moved pretty fast on this, even in the last few years. So that's the huge way. I think in the small way, you know, the Republican candidates came out against these unelected judges, but I think it basically goes away even more than the Affordable Care Act goes away.
I mean, this is what I was wondering, which is that it's clear that in very short order, gay marriage is just going to be routine. It'll be routine around the country. No one is going to think twice about it. It's not going to be an issue. Will the exhortations that the conservative justices made about judicial intervention, judicial supremacy, judicial activism, will that have durability? Will that animate conservatives, or even that won't last because the issue itself is going to disappear?
The issue itself doesn't disappear. So people have been saying, well, this is going to be like Roe versus Wade, and the reason it won't be, I don't think, is that there is not the animating passion against same-sex marriage that there is against abortion rights. And that's what underlies the continuing effort. I mean, there will obviously be groups that will try and do things at the state level, but it's not, I think your point was the right one, which is that it requires underlying passion about the specific law or specific issue. And there's much more of that passion for getting rid of Obamacare than there is for not allowing same-sex marriage.
Yeah, I mean, there are no victims in same-sex marriage the way people perceive them, the way there are with abortion, and that's a huge difference. I think, though, that the religious liberty fight has just begun, and what we're about to have are a whole bunch of state initiatives to try to carve out exemptions for religious people and also for religiously owned businesses. We've already seen those fights start, and they backfired in Indiana and Arkansas earlier this year, but this is not over by a long stretch. And I honestly can't decide what I think about the merits here in terms of how accommodationist the gay rights winners of this battle should be toward religious people who are going to take a while, maybe a really long time to get used to this idea, or whether we're going to end up with like a red state, blue state divide in which religious liberty stands for a kind of rallying cry to continue arguing about the underlying morality of gay relationships and marriages.
There will be. I think that's right. It's a proxy fight for it, but the numbers are smaller, and you also need the issue to come back up in the religious liberty context. In other words, you need another pizza, you know, an outcry over, or a federal event where somebody tries on religious liberty grounds not to participate in a gay wedding ceremony, and then it becomes a fight, and that is the rallying. I mean, that all has yet to happen. I totally agree with you that the religious liberty is the sort of stronger place to go for a conservative, but I also don't think, if you take the whole, I don't know that the religious liberty fight is as large as the abortion fight was.
If I were this is to change the subject slightly, but if I were a Republican running for office, running for president, doing anything in 2016, I would just be so jolly. This has been the best week ever. You get Obamacare, you can still campaign against it, and marriage equality disappears as an issue, and you don't have to. And you don't. What you don't have is you don't have the animating energy of the gay community working for Democratic candidates. And it's
and one more point: you get to keep railing against the liberal Supreme Court,
and you get to keep railing against the judges. Yep.
Yeah, never mind that it's run by Chief Justice John Roberts, a George W. Bush appointee, and has a majority of Republican-nominated justices on it. And we should say a word about the dissents today. There are four dissents every conservative wrote to object. They start with Roberts, and he really
Except
makes
Kennedy.
A strong case.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Kennedy with the majority on gay rights, right? He's like the gay rights all-star judge. So in this case, we're talking about Alito, Thomas, Scalia, and Roberts as the conservatives. And you know, Roberts really makes a strong case for the democratic process, and there are a lot of warnings about what it means to bypass that process in terms of people's acceptance of gay marriage. And I think that it's overblown just as a social phenomenon, and when you look at the polls and how fast they're changing, I think that's clear. But there is a kind of fundamental point here about the role of the judiciary and process. And while I don't think that's in any way going to, you know, put any kind of damper on the celebrations among supporters of gay marriage, among opponents and conservatives generally, it continues the role of the court as this rallying cry in election season, which I think is super useful to Republicans.
I think that's right, although, you know, the people who are rallied by the Supreme Court arguments and, you know, liberal judges' arguments get there pretty fast no matter what happens in the news. In other words, if you're looking at the incremental number of new people who are going to be on your side as a result of this decision who weren't already on your side on the question of judicial activism or the threat. For people who are worried about judicial activism, the threat of a Democratic president for two terms who could name the replacement judges is a sufficient threat to get them, most of them, worked up anyway. And while you may gain a few more in the weeks after this decision, I think without another flashpoint on religious liberty, as you pointed out earlier, I think you're not going to get a whole new massive group of people who are going to kind of go to the polls or vote against Hillary Clinton than you would have had otherwise before this decision.
I totally agree, but what about rallying the base? I mean, the Supreme Court really is up for grabs in the next election, right? We have four judges between the ages of, I think, 76 and 80. Or 80 or so. I mean, that this is it. And conservatives usually are better at making political hay out of that and grasping the significance of it.
Yeah, I guess my point is, though, that they're going to rally on that judge question. They would have rallied on it anyway.
We gotta vacate the studio because there's another Supreme Court podcast that has to come in here. Or actually, Dahlia's got to do a radio spot. So that is going to do it for our quickie mini Gab Fest. We will talk. We'll talk again on next week. We'll probably end up doing a larger segment on this. But for John Dickerson and Emily Bazelon, I'm David Plotz. Happy Marriage Equality Day to you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets. I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.